Well, the remaining portion of today's text, I'll pick it up at verse 12 in chapter 10 of Ecclesiastes. The words of a wise man's mouth will win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be, and who can tell him what will be after him. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Though through sloth the roof sinks in, and through indolence the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Well, I've preached well over 1,000 sermons, but today is unique. I've never had a sermon with the word flies or perfume in the title. And we got them both right here. And if you continue on in the text, not in the ESV, but other versions, you come across the word stink. I haven't preached a sermon on stink either. But this chapter is in the form of Proverbs. So it's kind of random thoughts that are brought together here. So there'll be several different themes that we're looking at as we work through the chapter. Well, he begins with that famous phrase, dead flies make the perfumer's ointment give off a stench. A little folly outweighs wisdom and honor. What a great word picture that is of dead flies and stinking perfume. He's pointing out that it doesn't take much evil or folly to mess up what wisdom has done. As Paul says, a little leaven leavens the whole lump of dough. We pointed this out last week. You can have a great plan and all kinds of processes in place, and all you need is one guy to come along and tweak that plan, and the whole thing falls apart. Even if he's intending to do good with his plan, he can still mess it up. He might think he's helping, but it collapses because of what he's done. And you end up with stinky perfume. So let's be careful what we say and do. Even some of your good intentions can be destructive and might be involved in folly. Now, I don't believe in preaching politics from the pulpit. But when you have a text like verse 2, what can I do? A wise man's heart inclines him to the right, but a fool's heart to the left. No, just kidding. Actually, that left and right distinction in politics really didn't get started until around the time of the French Revolution. It had to do with where you sat in Parliament, whether you're on the left or the right. So to take this and apply it to politics today is to totally misconstrue the passage. His point is that wisdom and folly are diametrically opposed. They lean away from each other. Wisdom is going this way while folly is trying to pull this way. He adds that even the fool, when he walks down the street, displays his folly all the time. You can look at the guy and saying, yeah, there's a fool. So he's trying to urge us in this to move toward wisdom and to shun folly. But then he talks about the rulers over us. Look at verse 4. If the anger of the ruler rises against you, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. And there is an evil that I have seen under the sun, as it were, an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in many high places, and the rich sit in low places. I have seen slaves on horses and princes walking on the ground like slaves. Now remember, this is a proverb. This is not an absolute command. There are plenty of examples of David, of Paul, and even Jesus, where they didn't stand their ground, but rather they fled a dangerous situation. Several times in the Gospels, you read of Jesus slipping out of their midst, undetected. But there are times when you should stand for the right and not flee. I watched it was only like a 15, 20-minute speech. It was a commencement address delivered by this Navy admiral, I forget what university. He was a SEAL, had been his entire time in the Navy. And his speech was 10 life lessons that he learned through SEAL training. One aspect of the training was that they got dropped off and had to swim in the shark-infested waters off of San Clemente. And they were instructed that you hold your ground. If a shark comes to you, don't try and flee. You hold your ground. If he gets close enough, you punch him in the snout, and he will flee. And I'm thinking, yeah, that's okay for you. But they have never lost a trainee to a shark in that part of their test. It works. Hold your ground. Now, I'm wondering if the admiral had read here in Ecclesiastes, because he also talks about the necessity, in that whole promise, the necessity of remaining calm. Not freaking out all over the place, but remaining calm. Verse 4, if the anger of the ruler against you rises, do not leave your place, for calmness will lay great offenses to rest. Great lesson for us there. So when we're in conflict, especially with a ruler, being calm and holding your ground may in fact bring that whole thing to some resolution. Now, wisdom helps us to know when we take that kind of stand and when simply just to walk away. It's foolish to try and fight every battle. It's exhausting. We need to stand on the important ones and let other stuff pass. We won't serve the cause of Christ well if we're fighting and contradicting anybody and everybody that disagrees with our position on something. We never get done with it. Confrontation is important and necessary, but not constantly and not for every issue. Calmness is a key to this whole process too. If you're up in people's faces and you're ranting and raving all the time, you make the situation worse. If we take the example of Jesus, there's only two times recorded, and some would say it's the same time. I think there's two different events of when Jesus actually acted out in anger. That was when he cleansed the temple. Now, I think one was in the beginning of his ministry, the other associated with the triumphal entry. Only two times in those years of ministry. Now, he did have other times when he rebuked the scribes and Pharisees with some sharpness. But how do we see him acting most of the time? Calm, peaceful, compassionate. Even with guilty sinners, he deals with them that way. So, if he can deal with some calmness, seems to me, so can we. And we avoid a whole lot of exacerbation of situations when we do so. Verse 6 tells us that folly is set in many high places. Now, we're certainly not exempt here in this country from folly residing in high places. We see it almost every day in one person or another. And we don't know which way our nation will go. Will it go toward wisdom? Will it go toward folly? There's no way we can know that today. But the signs of resistance to Christianity and the teaching of the Bible are certainly apparent and certainly seem to be rising. So pressure from government on local, state, or national levels may increase in coming days. and we need to know with wisdom how and when to respond. Do we stand our ground calmly? Do we flee? What do we do? We'll need real wisdom when that day arrives. In verses 8 to 11, he talks about some of the troubles that we have in life. The first section, I think he's talking about intentional evil schemes that backfire on us. When he talks about the guy who digs a pit and then falls into it, you get the sense he was digging this pit for somebody else to fall in. You know, maybe a trap of some sort, but he ends up falling in himself. Or breaking through a wall. Why would you be breaking through a wall other than theft? So you start pulling out rocks of the wall, and what happens? Whammo! Snake bites you. Okay. So the evil designs we have for others come back and fall on us ourselves. We're not given all of that, but some of this is actually reminds me of Looney Tunes cartoons or something. You know, a guy's doing this and ends up coming back on it, or the Road Runner or something. In his book, which some of you helped to type, 40 Years in the Wilderness, Jerry Piercy tells of his first experience in major crime. He broke into a drugstore and stole as many drugs as he'd get a hold of and left, went back to this bar where his friend convinced him to go back and get some more. That was pretty foolish right there. The other guy is sitting in the getaway car. Jerry goes in through the front door that he had broken in before and looking around for more stuff, and then he hears, "Take one more step and you're dead." He doesn't take another step. The owner of the store had come, and this was before the police got there, and he held Jerry at gunpoint until the police got there and hauled him off. Now, he broke through the wall, through the door. Wasn't a snake that got him, but the police got him. It was evil intent. And what happened? It fell back on him and started a lifelong of crime and deception. Now, the next two verses, I think, change flavor a little bit, where it's not talking about having an evil design in something, but rather the hazards of the workplace. The dangers of being crushed by stones that you're quarrying, or the dangers that come from splitting wood. You know, something flies off and hits you or hits someone else. It's the numerous dangers that people face in their everyday occupations every day. And because of that, you're aware of this, that page after page after page of all kinds of rules and regulations have come down. If you're going to do this, you got to wear this, and you got to have that, and all sorts of things, from the gear that we wear to warnings about not trying to do this when you're tired, not trying to do this when you're on medication or using drugs or alcohol or anything like that. And even though we apply all those pages of safety instructions, did it solve the problem entirely? No, people still get injured on the job. Things happen. Tools break or whatever. So it's nothing new. Been happening since ancient times. In verse 10, he talks about applying wisdom then to how you use your tools. If you're going to chop down a tree, sharpen your axe first. It's a whole lot easier working with a good tool. Same thing would apply. If you're going to cut down a tree, sharpen your chainsaw. You know, don't be stupid. Don't make your work a whole lot harder than it needs to be. Apply wisdom. And wisdom helps you succeed. Wisdom's been applied to the workplace in many ways for a long time. And because of that, what has happened? Are we still confined to trying to sharpen a stone and accomplish something? No, we have all sorts of tools that make our tasks easier, more accurate, and life is better because of them. It just like blows me away when I think about what early settlers here in this country would have had to gone through. You know, they're out in the wilderness. First of all, you have maybe wildlife that's not too pleased with you being there that you got to be aware of. But then, you know, you got to clear an area, so you're cutting down trees by hand. You build a log cabin with the logs that you cut down by hand. You got to dig out the stumps so you can plant some crops and that sort of thing, all by hand. If you're not near a stream, you got to dig a well by hand. Unbelievable what they went through. But wisdom applied to those kinds of things has done what for us? We have tools and machinery and all that sort of thing that make those tasks way, way easier than they used to be. And we now also have people devoted to those trades that give their lives to doing that kind of work, so we don't have to do it at all. We just shell out a few bucks and they come and do it for us. You see the benefits of applying wisdom in those kinds of areas. Now, wisdom tells us also to use the proper tool. Now, most of us, at one time or another, have not done that. How many have used the butt end of a screwdriver as a hammer? You ever done that? Sure you have. An adjustable wrench as a hammer. We've done that too. Ever use a dime as a screwdriver? Sometimes it works. You know, we do that sort of thing. If we don't have the tool we need, you use what you got. Well, wisdom says, no, you might be better off actually going and getting the tool that you need, even if it takes five more minutes. But verse 11 is a bit confusing. What in the world does he mean there? If the serpent bites before it's charmed, there's no advantage to the charmer. That's a head scratcher, isn't it? And when you come up to a head scratcher, you go to a commentary and see what that guy has to say. And more often than not, you get contradictory messages. But Zach Eswine, in his book, said this: "So the preacher adds a bit more poetry. If the serpent bites before it's charmed, there's no advantage to the charmer. What good is a leader who does not show how to wisely handle the threatening situation in front of him and believes that he requires no learning to counter the ignorance he currently possesses? Having such a leader is like having a snake charmer who, for all of his pomp and words and dazzle and show, still gets bitten by the rising cobra. There was no ultimate advantage to that generation, no matter how the one in charge dressed, danced, and chanted, the community still got snake bit." So, you got to have the understanding, you got to have the wisdom, you got to have knowledge in order to accomplish certain things. And you put yourself out there as a snake charmer, but can't charm a snake, you're going to get bit. So, we need to, again, learn that application of wisdom. But this doesn't apply only to leaders, I don't think. We all need to proceed wisely. We need to learn what to do and when to do it. And that's true in our everyday lives, but it's certainly true in our dealings with people as the children of God. We need to be even more careful in this regard when we're dealing as God's people. So let's turn away from, like we sang with the kids earlier, let's turn away from vengeance and caustic talk and that sort of thing. Let's trash our pride and our arrogance and seek the humility of Christ as we deal with one another in wisdom. We do need wisdom in our dealings with one another, here at church, at home, with our neighbors, wherever. Let's not assume we know it all and that there's nothing for us to learn. That's arrogance. That's folly. And Coelette, I mean, how many times has he trounced all over those ideas as we've gone through the book? Verse 12, "The words of the wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end is talk of his talk is evil madness. Fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be and what will come after him. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he doesn't know the way to the city." ESV uses the word favor. Many of the other English versions say that his words are gracious. And the word used here is the word for grace, And grace and favor certainly are go together. So he's going to set a stark contrast again between the wise man and the fool. The wise man's words are gracious, and they bring him favor. The things he says are beneficial to others. People are inclined to listen to him because he can offer sound advice. If you have to make a difficult decision, don't you tend to seek out someone who can give you that sound advice? Somebody with some wisdom, somebody with some experience? Even political leaders, big-time corporate managers, etc., want wise people around them, people that can give them good counsel. The contrast Qohelet presents here is against the words of the fool. And it's interesting how the passage is laid out. What he says about the wise is half a verse. What he says about the fool is three and a half verses. Isn't that the way it seems in life? You can find a fool kind of around every corner, but to find a genuinely wise person is pretty rare. So the fool gets eaten up by his words. Rather than being beneficial to him or to others, they're destructive. Look at the indictment in verse 13. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. If we compare that with the statement made several times elsewhere, that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, we can assume that the fool is beginning without God. And the end of that process is, as the text says, madness. It's a disaster. And we can find the blather of fools in the newspaper, in textbooks, in entertainment media, on the news. It's all around us. And the majority of our nation most likely buys into it on one level or another. Studies and polls can just as easily crank out folly as they can wisdom. But if we start without God and His truth, no matter what we pursue, folly will catch up with us, and most likely before too long. It's true, too, that a fool can blab on and on. He multiplies words, he says. Sometimes he's just spurting out nonsense. At other times, he's presenting a well-reasoned treatise, but it's false and will lead others astray. On this, Adam says, in verse 15, we encounter a proverb that is somewhat akin to our expression, he doesn't have the sense enough to come in out of the rain because he can't even find his way to the city. Something so large, therefore so obvious, you'd think it was easy to do. His labor is worthless. He puts out effort, but it produces nothing but weariness. Why does he keep up at a fruitless effort? Why does he think that more and more of the same thing will finally get results? But we see that on a regular basis. Keep doing it, spend more on it, and somehow magically new results are expected. That's folly. The beginning is bad, but the end is madness. And we have to turn from that kind of thinking and behavior ourselves. We try to see that sort of thing. We need to look for it in our own lives. We need to begin with God and His Word and be guided by His truth. That will help us avoid folly and madness. Kids, let me talk to you for a second. What is this made out of? Made out of wood. Pretty hard, right? What is this made out of? Huh? All right, it's paper, but it's related to wood, isn't it? What if I told you that I'm going to cut the top of this pew end off here, and I'm going to use a piece of paper, okay? And I go like I'm sewing. Did you see that mark I made? You see that? No, it's not there, is it? Well, let's do it some more. Let's say I did this. I never went home. I stayed here all week, never slept, stayed here, and did this all week. Would the top be off? No, the paper would wear out, wouldn't it? I'd have a little stub left right here in my hand, but nothing that I could use to cut that. But if I said, I just need to do it longer, I need to do it maybe for another whole week, what would you think of me at that point? You say, he's a loony. That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. You can't cut a big, thick piece of wood with a piece of paper. That doesn't work. That's, what would Kohelet in Ecclesiastes call it? That is, starts with an F. Say it with me. Folly. Say it again. Folly. Okay? It's craziness. It's madness to do that sort of thing. Now, if I really wanted to cut that, I have several tools at home that would cut that off in just a few seconds. I could use a sawzall. I could use a circular saw. I could bring in a chainsaw. That'd make a big mess, though. But wisdom tells us which way to go. And to stick with folly ends in madness. It doesn't get the job done, and people start to understand that you're just crazy, that can't possibly work. So, going back to what he said before, we need to start our thoughts with God and let his word guide us to help us avoid this kind of stupid thing in life, okay? Because there's a whole lot of stupid that we can do that we need to avoid, all right? Well, in verse 16, he gets back to speaking about the rulers again. He said, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, and your princes feast in the morning. And happy are you when your land, when your king is the son of nobility," and that sort of thing. Now, I don't want this to be political, but did you happen to see the comments by David Hogg this past week? He was ranting on and on about the older generations and that they need to get out of the way and let people like him rule. He's what, 17 or 18 now? And he announced that when he's 25, he's running for Congress. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child. Why would that be true? Well, a child lacks experience, therefore hasn't gained sufficient wisdom to rule. And when that is the case, it usually means trouble for the nation. That's why we have laws against it. Kohelet also promises woe to those leaders who feast in the morning. Now, he's not saying you can't have yourself a good breakfast. That's not what his point. No, rather, he's condemning those who rise up to feast and revel, you know, first thing in the morning, that they're partying before doing the day's work. And that decries a self-indulgent heart, seeking pleasure before responsibility. On the other hand, he says the nation is happy when they have responsible and a well-trained leader. He knows when feasting is appropriate, and he eats for strength out of necessity, not out of overindulgence. In other words, he's not a party animal. And he's most likely continuing to speak about kings and princes when he says, through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. It's true of all of us, though. If we're so lazy as to neglect our home or our car, our stuff, pretty soon everything will no longer be in working condition. Our house will be falling down around us because we have not cared for it. So if you have a leader like that, then the whole country is in trouble. Nations as well as houses need regular maintenance. Now, some of you participated in our crazy project at our house a few years ago. We had a basement wall that was badly bowed and ready to cave in. And those of you who weren't there, it was a sight to be seen. We built a chute coming from the road, you know, the hill, our house is way down the hill. A chute that came down in the family room window. I cut a big hunk of the family room floor out, built a form wall underneath it, and we poured through the floor into the form 13 and a half yards of steel reinforced concrete. I think if we have a major earthquake, the safest place will be right next to our wall that used to be caving in. Well, what if I hadn't done that? I think the south end of our house would have caved in by now and maybe brought the rest of the house with it. We'd have been in serious trouble had we not done that. Now, sometimes maintenance is as simple as just new caulk around a couple of windows. Other times it's a major ordeal, like our wall. But it's got to be done, or what happens? Your roof leaks, it caves in, you know, whatever it is. Verse 19, I can't figure out if he's positive here or negative. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Is this tongue-in-cheek sarcasm? Or is he saying that food and wine and money, if used properly, are good things and are great benefit to the user? I think that's a possibility also. But they are so easily corrupted that it's easy to fall prey to misuse. So is it sarcastic warning or urging proper use? Not sure. But at least let's heed the possible warning that's there, not put our hope and trust in those kinds of things. Verse 20 sounds almost like he was thinking about, now he couldn't have been, but that he was thinking about the cyber world that we're in now. Look at it. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for the bird of the air will carry your voice, and some winged creature will tell the matter. You know, so you type something on your computer and you're thinking it's probably private, and next thing you know, it's out on Facebook or this or that, and you have no idea how it got there. You know, things are somewhat mysterious when it comes to those sorts of things. But his point can be well taken, is that we need to be careful of what we say and even of what we think. So this whole thing, if we could give a general topic to the whole chapter, because it laces in and out, he does seem to be talking somewhat about leaders and rulers and kings and the necessity of wisdom for them. And when he talks about the noble and responsible king who was the son of nobility and that sort of thing, he's speaking about things in this world that will always be tainted. A good king isn't always good at every turn. Even the emulated King David had some hideous flaws. So we can never get the kind of perfection that we desire here. Our kings and rulers will always have points of failure. And add to that our political perspectives. They may not necessarily have a moral failure, but we disagree with them harshly on that thing. So it's difficult. But there is a king who is more than a son of nobility. He's the son of God. And even though he came to us as a child, he grew and he lived perfectly under the law of God. He, the divine son, took our sin upon himself and bore the entire weight of God's wrath in his sufferings and death for us. He rules perfectly. You can't find anything in the Lord Jesus. No corruption, no greed, no selfishness, no power mongering. He's the perfect king. The one whose yoke is easy and whose burden is light. So as we deal with the stinky perfume of life under the sun, let's do so in the light of are standing in Christ. Our sins are forgiven. We're declared righteous in Him. We stand now perfected before God the Father. We're alive in Christ. He's given the Spirit to us. We have all the power we need to navigate this corrupt world with all of its weirdness and everything else. We will never be perfect until Christ returns. So we always will need Him and His sacrifice for us. But we already stand in our position perfected before God. So let's carry that into our thoughts. Make that the beginning point of our seeking of wisdom. And you don't end up then in madness. So let's carry those ideas into our thoughts and actions our dealings with authorities and our dealings with one another, that we would do so as the children of God. Let's come to his table.